Mark, I'm still a real alcoholic. Welcome back. I'm glad some of you decided to stick around. And we were talking about the medical hopelessness of alcoholism and drug addiction. Why am I a hopeless case? What am I doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? How come now I'm not in the clinic somewhere or bothering my family doctor? What am I doing here? I heard a cowboy from Nevada talk about this once. And he kind of shook his head and he says, I don't know. He says, you know, them drugs and alcohol. He says, it's kind of like the coyote making love to the skunk. He didn't know if he had enough, but he had all he could stand. That's what I'm doing here. Why is that? Why are we hopeless, and what did Dr. Silkworth figure out? And that's what we're going to start in on now. Again, third edition, we're XXVI. Fourth edition, we're XXVIII. First paragraph on that page. Dr. Silkworth writes, we believe, and so suggested, that the action of alcohol, and read your drug of choice there, the action of alcohol on these alcoholics is the manifestation of an allergy. An allergy, a problem of the body. And Dr. Silkworth tagged this allergy with the name, the phenomenon of craving. What's a phenomenon? That's something we know is real, but we cannot explain. We can watch a galaxy form in a telescope, but we do not know how it happens. We know that it is real, but we do not understand it. Dr. Silkworth watched his patients craving their drug of choice and unable to do anything about it. And he felt that this was an allergy of the body, and he called it the phenomenon of craving. And he said about this allergy that it is limited to this class, that's us, and never, he uses the word never, occurs in the average temperate drinker. When I came to AA, they said, I had an allergy. They said, Mark, you're allergic to alcohol. And I said, that's bullshit. I'm drinking a quart, 2 quarts a day. I ain't breaking out in hives, you know. I don't get a rash. I said, you guys are, you know, duh. And my sponsor said, you don't understand. Why don't you look up allergy in the dictionary? And I said, I don't have to look up allergy in the dictionary. I'm a doctor. And he said, no, you're an asshole, and go look it up in the dictionary. He's a great big guy, this guy, my first sponsor. So I went and looked it up in the dictionary. And he pointed out to me that one definition of an allergy is an abnormal reaction to a substance. An abnormal reaction to a substance. And he characterized it for me in this fashion. He said, okay, Mark, you and your buddy are going to go downtown. You're going to get all dressed up. You're going to go downtown to one of your favorite places. You're going to have some drinks, and you're going to dance with the girls. So you get dressed up. You go downtown. You walk up to the bar. Mark, you order your Jack Daniels. Your buddy orders a scotch and soda. You start dancing with the girls and having a good time. The evening goes by. It's closing time. Your buddy is going home with this beautiful girl, while you, Mark, are in jail in Utah. That is an abnormal reaction to the substance. Okay? You went out and played some golf. You had going to have a few beers with your buddies. and you end up upside down in your car on 680 going the wrong direction, that's an abnormal reaction to the substance. Okay? You know, you were going to Safeway to cash your check, and 5 days later you wake up in a motel in Rhode Island. That's an abnormal reaction to the substance. Okay? The allergy of the body. Let's see if we can get a little better handle on this. Dr. Sokol says this never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Did you ever talk to an average temperate social drinker? Did you ever hang around with anybody like that? I never did. Now, before we talk to this temperate drinker, you know, let's just, for the record, tell you what they consider a drink is. One four ounce glass of normal table wine. Not Thunderbird, Mad Dog, you know. 1 4-ounce glass of wine. A 12-ounce can of American beer. You know, not export, not 44, you know, 12-ounce beer. Or 1 ounce to maybe 1.5 ounces of 86 proof whiskey, which they usually put in 8 ounces of liquid and take 1 hour to drink. That's a drink to these people, okay? To them, that's a normal drink. I spill that much getting up in the morning. Okay. So you talk to these people and you say to them, Charlie, how do you feel when you have a drink? And they go, well, gee. They got to like think about it, you know? And they go, well, I get kind of a warm, comfortable feeling. And I said, yeah, then what? And they go, nothing. Man, I slam one of those shots. I feel that fire hit the back of my neck. My head swells up. It burns all the way down. I feel it hit bottom. It shoots out into my arms and my legs. I'm James Bond, United States Marine Corps, all rolled into one. And if you don't nail this town down, I'm going to rip it to shreds. I don't get a warm, comfortable feeling, man. If it made it a warm, comfortable feeling, I wouldn't drink that crap either. I feel wonderful when I drink. I feel powerful. I feel invulnerable. No, not these people. Not the normies. They just get a warm, comfortable feeling. And then if you ask them, okay, warm, comfortable feeling, great. Suppose you have another drink, and they go, right away? Wow, you know, yeah, right away, now. And they go, oh, no, I would never do that. Why not? They say, I get all spinny. And I said, you don't like spinning? No, I don't like that out of control feeling. I said, yeah, out of control, that's what we're after. Oh, no, I don't like that. Ooh. I said, okay, great. A warm, comfortable feeling, spinny, out of control. Suppose you have another drink on top of that. I would never do that. Why not? Oh, then I get all sick and dizzy and I start to sweat and I throw up. You're drinking with these normies. They have more than 3 drinks in 1 hour. Push back. They're going to puke all over you. They have a defense. Their body tells them toxic, dangerous. Eliminate. What do? Give me more, faster, more fuel, step on the gas. We have no warning at all. Or if you ask them, you say, how many times have you been drunk? They go, oh, two. You know, once in college, or when I was in high school, my buddies and I tried some for the first time, and I got sick. And then once when I got out of the Navy, and that's it, two. How many times you guys been drunk? 10,000? 20,000? You know? So. Because they just don't react the way we do at all. It doesn't make them feel wonderful. Okay? And medical science now has actually documented and pretty much proven the medical allergy of the body. And we'll use alcohol as an example. But the other drugs will kind of fall in as we talk about this. All right, you put alcohol in my brain, and the first effect is a euphoric narcotic effect. It's alcohol, but it changes into a brain to a substance that is 10 times as potent as heroin. And it has a definite narcotic opiate effect. Now, what does that mean? It means you feel euphoric. You feel wonderful. Everything's okay. You know, I mean, I'm getting divorced. I just got fired. I kited 3 checks, and I forgot which banks I wrote them on. But I walk in the bar, and 3 drinks later, it's the most wonderful day I've ever had. You know, everything is just great. And it's also a very potent painkiller. So it has a narcotic effect in the brain. Like heroin, like morphine, like Dilaudid, Oxycontin, Vicodin, you know, all mommy's little helpers. Boom. And that's why I'm in the bar, the guy's 10 times as big as me, he just punched me as hard as he could. And I'm saying to him, is that all you got, punk? Because I can't feel it. Because I have that tremendous narcotic opiate effect going on in my mind. That's effect number one. Number two is the stimulant effect. Works down deep in the brain in the dopamine system. Gives us tremendous energy. Get up and go. How do you think I got to Utah to get in jail? I've actually been in jail in Utah, and those Mormons are kind of rigid. But anyway, powerful, invulnerable, you know, and a lot of get up and go. That's why you end up dancing on the tables and running around the parking lot. And that's how you get from Safeway to Rhode Island. You know, you get a lot of energy, a lot like methamphetamine, cocaine. You know, delusions of grandeur. Illusions of power. And then the third effect in the brain is a tranquilizer effect, like Valium, Ativan, and all those other mommy's little helpers. And so everything is okay. Everything's fine. I'm not worried about anything. Everything's cool. You know, and all those little voices, blah, 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 blah. Shh. I'm gone. Gone. So I'm feeling wonderful, I'm feeling no pain, I'm feeling powerful and invulnerable, and I have no conscience. Surprised I'm going to get in trouble? And that's how the allergy works in our brain. And once we put it in and we get this effect, we want more. And we don't care what's in our way. We don't care what we do, we get more. Some of us, you know, we drink now, we don't make it till dawn, we're in jail. Others of us, we drink now, it takes 6 weeks, some of us a year, but eventually we get to a similar spot. And because of the understanding of how this works in the brain and genetic engineering, they can now breed alcoholic drug addict animals. They can make a heroin rat or an alcohol rat or a Valium rat. And what they'll do is they'll give this rat some alcohol, get the phenomenon of craving started. And then they'll put an interested, significant other rat, food, and water, three basic instincts of life. And they'll put the alcohol over there. The rat will walk right by those three basic instincts of life. He'll go over to the tray where the alcohol is, and he will stay there and drink it till he dies. They can take the same rat, and they can put an electrode in his brain. And they'll teach him, if he pushes this pedal, he'll think he had a drink. And he'll walk right by the female rat, the food, the water, go up to the little pedal, and he'll stand there and he'll push it till he dies. So the allergy is real. The allergy is physical. We are hardwired for addiction. And, you know, you're hardwired for this. So you go out in society and someone says, well, if I hadn't gone to that college, I never would have been an alcoholic. Please, you know. You're hardwired for this stuff. So however you contact the substance, however it gets in your body, now you're lit up. And it's just a matter of time until you enter the deeper stages of addiction. We got it. Those folks out there ain't got it. You know, Charlie with the warm, comfortable feeling, he ain't got it. I got it. And like my first sponsor used to say, he said, Mark, you want to know why you're an alcoholic? I says, yeah, why? He says, well, it's like that game you played in first grade, Mark. You're it. And you're going to be it for the rest of your life. You got it. They ain't got it. That's about all the knowledge you need to go to AA. Okay, there's another way to characterize the allergy a little better. And it's based on a set of questionnaires and tests that now have been administered to about 300 million people over about 30 years. So it's pretty good data. And it comes down to four little questions. And for those of you who are going to work with alcoholics and their families, a lot of times the question's going to come up. Am I an alcoholic? Am I a drug addict? You know, am I an addiction person? And you can use these little questions to make the diagnosis and sometimes give families a little insight into what's going on. And the way you remember these little questions is the word CAGE. Now, usually CAGE is pretty easy for an alcoholic or a drug addict to remember. I don't know about you, but I've been in several publicly financed cages. And so it's easy for me to remember, you know. I want my phone call. And for those of us who have not been the guests of various government organizations, we can remember the self-constructed prison that we lived in day after day. Our own cage that we made all by ourselves. Okay, so the word cage. First letter, C, you ask them, have you ever tried to cut down or control your drinking? Yeah, I did. It was that 14th margarita that got me in trouble, so I'm going to cut down to 12. You know, switch from Jack Daniels to beer. Never do that. No more cocaine for me. I'm just going to drink Ripple. Yeah. Now, you know, warm, comfortable feeling, spinny. These normies don't have to control their drinking. They don't have to use willpower. They don't have to go to the party with a drinking plan or a designated driver. They have, can you imagine, they have one drink and they get all they want? Did you ever see them oh, that's a little sour. I don't think I want that. And they put it on the mantle and walk away. Got a lot of free drinks that way, man. Have you ever tried to cut down? They just don't get a bang on it. I was on an airplane once, that I remember anyway, and this guy had this glass of, I guess it was, soda or 7-Up or something. He had this bottle, those little bitty bottles that you get in the airplane. You can inhale those things. And he had it, and he was pouring it into his glass. And he kept holding that bottle up to the light like this. He was driving me crazy, And he's pouring a little more, and he's holding it up to the light like this. And he put the top on it, and he put it in his pocket. I could not. We were in baggage claim, and I had it. I walked down, and he said, excuse me. I said, what are you going to do with that bottle you got in your pocket? He looked at me, and he says, when I get home, I'm going to make me another drink. Okay, John Wayne, Jesus, that's sick. So that guy, does he have to control or cut down his drinking? Never. He doesn't have the allergy. Okay. Next, A. Has anyone ever asked you about your drinking? Mark, that's your fifth martini. Ah, shut up and eat your breakfast. Yeah. Yeah, or, you come downstairs, you're somewhere for the weekend, and, it's morning, sort of, and you come down and, nobody's talking to you. Or you say to them, well, let's go out and have some fun. And they say, well, you've been drinking all night. I says, yeah, well, I'm not done. Everything's closed. Well, let's go open it. Have you ever been asked about your drinking? Or, good evening, sir. My name is Officer Smith of California Highway Patrol. Have you been drinking tonight? Well, I just had one beer. Step out of the car, please. DUI is being asked about your drinking. Getting arrested for public intoxication is being asked about your drinking. Getting fired for drinking is being asked about your drinking. Getting divorced for drinking is being asked about your drinking. So, have you ever been asked about your drinking? A little guy in the plane with a little bottle and nobody asks him about that except me, an alcoholic. G, have you ever felt guilty about your drinking? You wake up and you don't know where you are, or you go outside and your car is missing, or you go outside and the left side of it's all caved in, and it's got blood on it, and you're going, I hope that was a deer. Yeah. Or it's as simple and tragic as saying to yourself, God, I did that again last night. I swore I wasn't going to do that, and I did that again last night. I wasn't going to get drunk. I wasn't going to get loaded, and look, here I am again. Or you wake up, and you see that light fixture that's got the wire thing around it, and you go, oh no, here I am again. So, have you ever felt guilty about your drinking? And the last one is E. Have you ever had an eye-opener or a drink in the morning? Whenever morning happens to be, our clocks are a little different than most people. But really, it's not just a drink in the morning. It's, have you ever had to have a drink or a drug to just steady down enough to do the next thing? Like get out of bed, sign a check, make a phone call, drive a car. Yeah, you know, have you ever had to have a drink to steady down enough to just barely function? Okay, if you or the people you're talking to answer yes to any one of those questions, there's about an 86% chance they're alcoholic drug addict. If the answer to any two is yes, then it's 96% plus. I get all four right. I get an A on the test. I don't know about you guys. Okay. So that kind of characterizes the allergy for us pretty well. It's been documented by medical science, and you can tell from those questions the kind of behaviors that the allergy produces. And remember, we got it, we're it, nobody else has it. Okay. Now that's real nice to know that you're allergic to alcohol and drugs. That's great. You know, oh, I'm allergic to alcohol, give me a drink, you know. And you can explain to people that, you know, they're allergic and it's very dangerous. But, you know, I'm allergic to penicillin. But you don't catch me at 4 a.m. breaking into a pharmacy, stealing a case of penicillin, going to Motel 6 with the number of an escort service, and staying there until the penicillin's all gone, and then make it a plan to get some more. I don't do that with penicillin. But I sure do that with alcohol and drugs. What's the deal here? Some guy's allergic to bees? You don't see him running around sticking his arm in beehives. There must be something else wrong with me besides an allergy of the body. What's the rest of the problem? I mean, I know I'm allergic to it. I know it'll kill or disable me, ruin my life. I got mountains of evidence to prove that I can't use the stuff. I mean, I've been in jail, I've been in a psych hospital, been divorced, I've lost my job. What's the matter with me? I go pick it up again. There must be something wrong with my mind, with my thoughts, and how I think about drugs and alcohol. And this was the other part that Dr. Silkworth figured out. And it's called the mental obsession. The obsession of the mind. What's an obsession? An obsession is an idea that overcomes all other ideas to the contrary, and we take action on it. And the obsession is a lie. Now, you take action based on a lie, you eventually run into the truth. And when you do, it beats your brains out. Example, Mark thinks he can fly. I have an obsession that I can fly. Now I know that in all of astrophysical literature, in recorded history, there has never been one case of a human flapping his arms and flying across the sky. But I think I'm different. And I have an obsession that I can do that. And I'm going to do that. And I'm going to go to San Francisco, and I'm going to climb up on the highest skyscraper I can find and jump off and flap my arms. And in about 4 seconds, I will run into the truth. Huh? Drinking, using, same deal. And Dr. Silkworth's the first guy to figure this out. And he characterizes that for us on the bottom of the page here. It's a two-part deal. All right, let's let him tell us about it. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Yeah. Don't tell me you like how it tastes. I just don't want to hear that. All right. They like the effect produced by alcohol. And while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. They lose touch with reality. To them, their alcoholic, drug addict life seems the only normal one. As we drink and use, we think we're doing fine. In fact, we think we're doing great. And if those assholes would just leave us alone and do as we say, everything would be fine. Example, I'm in county jail again, and I'm there for the usual crap. Drunk in public, failure to pay child support, assault and battery of a police officer, and criminal trespass. You know, big criminal guy, right? I'm in county jail again with these charges. I get my felony pled down to a misdemeanor. I get my sentencing changed from consecutive to concurrent. And I think I'm the most brilliant legal mind since Clarence Darrow in America. And I have demonstrated such innate ability that as soon as I get out of jail, I'm going to go to law school and become the greatest American criminal lawyer after I pick up a fifth of whiskey to help me fill out the application. Brilliant, right? I'm doing fabulous. In my pajamas and county jail. Second part. They are restless, irritable, and discontented. Now we're not drinking. See, we're dry. They are restless, irritable, and discontented until they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort. That wonderful, lifting, euphoric feeling which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see other people taking with impunity. And they succumb to the desire. So, what makes you restless, irritable, and discontent? Punching a time clock, paying bills, picking up the laundry, talking to your wife, answering the phone. Need breathing. You know, life. Makes me restless, irritable, and discontent. And I get this idea that this time it'll be different. This time, I'm just going to take the edge off. I'm going to have a couple drinks. I'm going to drink like a gentleman. Right? Yeah. I was locked up in this rehab. Well, it was really a psych hospital, but I was locked up in there and, yeah, I remember that I was telling this guy all about Napoleon and the Battle of Waterloo and how he screwed up and he didn't use it, you know, and I was going on and on about this whole thing, and the guy, he started pulling on my bathrobe, my sleeve, you know. He said, Mark, you're in a psychiatric facility. Mark. But anyway, I was in this place, and we were doing the little big book, you know. And it said in there, if you could drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to you. And I said, that's me. I can drink like a gentleman. And I had these visions of myself at a lawn party in this nice summer suit with a gin and tonic talking to these beautiful girls, you know, and impressing the hell out of them, you know. So finally I got myself out of there and they took me to the airport. Well, they actually took me onto the airplane and put me in my seat. And the plane took off, and, you know, right away, drink tray, hey, you know, Gin and tonic, please. I'm going to practice for lawn parties. So she gives me a gin and tonic, and I pour it in there, and I said, wow, that rehab must have called the airline. They're watering my booze. Miss, could I have four more of those? As it would, things would have it, this was over Utah. And three days later, I wake up in my kitchen in Ohio, naked. You know what blood looks like on a white appliance? You know, you smear it on a white appliance and it's about a day old. It gets that funny brown looking. All the appliances are smeared with blood. The furniture in the kitchen is totally destroyed. And there's red wine dripping from the ceiling. And as I start to clean this mess up, I find another DUI citation. You know, I drank like a gentleman. Yeah, this time it'll be different. This time we'll be okay. This time we won't get in trouble. Sure. How could you drink on the truth? How could you drink on the truth? You've got to believe a lie. Well, let's see. I think I'll have a couple beers and get divorced. Why don't I have a glass of sherry and get fired? I'll tell you what, let's go out, we'll have a couple cocktails, and we can turn our car over on 680 going 100 miles an hour. No, you know what we should do? We'll get some red wine and some amphetamines, and then we'll go over to Richmond and get shot. How can you drink on the truth? You've got to believe a lie. You have to believe the obsession. So it's the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And the obsession is really the crux of the problem. That's the big one. If we didn't have the mind deal, we could probably live with the allergy. But we got the mind deal. You know, so you can't drink because of your body. You've got the allergy. You can't quit because of your mind. So you can't drink. You can't quit. You are truly powerless over alcohol and drugs and absolutely helpless to do anything about it by yourself. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind. So I'm going to use the diseased mind to cure the diseased mind. That's going to work really good. And this is where the spirituality and the 12 steps come in. If the 12 steps are taken as outlined by the first 100 and Bill Wilson, who wrote this book, The Obsession of the Mind, is removed. I don't know how that happens. That is a total mystery. And I don't think there are a lot of people who say they know how that happens, but I think they're full of shit. It's a total mystery, but it's real. It's as real as us sitting here tonight. And once that obsession is removed, our desire to pick up is gone. And that's where the program really comes in. A good way to remember the obsession is what my first sponsor in Brooklyn always used to say to me, Mark, if it makes sense to you, don't do it. Okay. Now, the rest of the doctor's opinion, there's just a quick discussion of some classifications, which I don't think we need to belabor. And then Dr. Silkworth presents a couple of his cases where he documents the amazing transformation of patients that he took care of as a result of working in 12 steps. And I encourage you to read these on your own. I just want to tell you that these are very real. These are not unusual or exceptional. They happen all the time. And I myself have now seen many, many cases just like this. I'll just give you a couple so you get a feel for what we're talking about. The first one happened in Brooklyn. It was a hot July night in the ER. It was busy as hell. And, of course, the air conditioning was broken. And, you know, we were all stressed out. And I was working, and this guy tapped me on the shoulder. Well, somebody taps you on the shoulder in Brooklyn, you better jump back real far because you don't know what's coming. So I jumped back real far. I looked for security, and I said, "What do you want?" And he looked at me, and he said, "You don't remember me." I said, "I've never seen you before. What do you want?" And he said, "I'm so-and-so." I said, "No, you're not. I know that guy. That is not you." He said, "Oh, yeah, that's who I am." And he was going to show me ID. And I said, "This can't be." I mean, I've been in the program like about 2.5 years at that point. I mean, I'm working the 12 steps. I read the doctor's opinion. I heard about these cases. I didn't believe it. I didn't believe he saw a patient he couldn't remember and couldn't recognize that was transformed. I didn't believe that. And this guy's standing in front of me, and I'm going, "Oh, my God, I don't believe this. Are you really him?" He says, "Yeah, this is who this guy was." He was a wino like me, and he was sitting on the curb, and he happened to get in the middle of a drive-by shooting. He took one in the chest. They brought him in. His clothes were stuck to him with lice and dirt. So we couldn't even undress him to take care of his gunshot wound. We slapped the field dressing on his gunshot wound, threw him in a tub of chemicals, finally got his clothes off, got him up, put him on the table, fixed his gunshot wound. Told him, you know, "Go to AA, next case, you know." And I said to him, I wouldn't have bet a Chinese nickel on you. What did you do? He said, "I did what you guys told me to do. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I worked the steps, and I've been clean and sober for a year now, and I'm working, and I just wanted to come back here tonight and thank you for saving my life." And I fell to the floor. And I went home that night and I said, "God, Silkworth, you're not kidding, you know?" There it was, right before my eyes. The other one is a young girl. Again, this was in New York City. She was a 23-year-old girl from a prominent family in Manhattan. Been to every psychiatrist in Manhattan, taken every kind of psych med there was, tried to kill herself 5 times. She came to Alcoholics Anonymous with this story. She said, "You know, I just got sick and tired of going on this merry-go-round. So I started hoarding all my psych meds. I just hid them and I pretended I took them. And I waited for summertime when we were going to go up to our summer house." And she knew up by this summer house there was a river that connected to the ocean. And in the middle of this river was an island. And at high tide, the river would flood and the island would be submerged. So she got out the tide table. She figured it out. She stole a bottle of vodka off the bar. She took all her psych meds. She went out on this island. She took all the medicine and she washed it down with vodka and she laid down in the reeds. The tide came in and submerged her. Somebody noticed her missing in time. They had really good rescue dogs. They found her under the water. Helicoptered her out of there. Took her to a good hospital and saved her life. Now, with that story, she walks in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and she says, "If this doesn't work, this doesn't work, they'll never find me again." That girl works on Wall Street today. She's married. She has 2 beautiful children. She finds people you ever want to meet. So, you know, I don't care who you are. I don't care where you've been. I don't care what you've done. I don't care what you haven't done. If you want what's in this book, it's yours to be asking. These steps will kill you. They will kill that old person who brought you here, and on the ashes of that death will rise someone who's never been here before. God bless you, each and every one. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Okay, has anybody got any questions? Okay. Thanks for your presentation. It's been very, very enlightening. My question to you has to do with, I've been involved in this program for over 20 years, and I've constantly not been able to stay in it. I'm 60 days sober now, and my question has to do with that first drink. I fail to recognize or do the proper assessment. Every time I'm ready to take that first drink, I never remember the bad parts. I constantly just have a very disproportionate assessment of the pros and cons regarding the first drink. The negative thing seems to be never present. What's going on in the mind when that's taking place? Can you give us some information on that? During just that first drink, that decision point where we decide, we've been sober for 4 years, I'm okay now. What happened to all the negative parts that we seem to forget?
That is the obsession of the mind that you're describing. In my limited experience, most often, the person has not embraced their hopelessness. They still think there's some kind of chance that they're okay. They've never really embrace the first step and admitted that they were a hopeless case and that they truly were powerless over the substance, and which opens the door to everything else. Embrace the hopelessness. You know, I see this all the time. Talk to people and you say, okay, spiritual experience, alcoholic doom. And they go, yeah, spiritual experience. Can you tell me more about alcoholic doom? Yeah, you know. They don't think they're hopeless. So I just talked to a guy, he just got out of prison. And he went back to his house, and he used to use cocaine in the family room. And he was crawling around on the floor, snorting the carpet. And he was telling me about this. And he said, I don't understand, you know, why I relapsed. And I said, well, you think you're hopeless? And, you know, he got very offended. How dare I say that to him? But most of the time, the relapse is based on the failure to admit first step. You know, when you admit, what does it say on the movie ticket? It says, admit one, right? That means they let you in. When you admit, you allow the power that created you into your heart. Now, that's the first step part of it. There's 11 more things. You can go through each of the steps and analyze and talk about relapse. And that's something you need to do with your sponsor. You need to go carefully through each step. Because in each step, I've given you the part of the first step, relapse talk. But there is actually a long discussion in each step. And this guy here is probably one of the finest experts on that I have ever encountered.
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much for that.
God bless you.
Dr. Martin.
Hello. What's the significance of a year clean and sober time?
A year clean and sober. Very, very significant. Extremely significant. Because that's when withdrawal from alcohol finally starts to wind down. Now, alcohol withdrawal lasts at least 12 months. And a lot of the other drugs and stuff do too. In fact, in the old days, in AA, 1 year sober, they used to have a big party, bake a cake, and everything. They didn't know about withdrawal. They didn't know all this stuff. But they knew that if the alcoholic made it through the first year, his chances of staying sober were greatly increased, and they celebrated 1 year. Acute alcohol withdrawal, usually in the first 10 days, that's when we got the shakes, the pukes, seeing stuff coming out of the walls. Now we can get DTs and die. Acute withdrawal, piece of cake, nothing to it. I mean, how many times have you done that, huh? How many times have you shook it out, right? I mean, come on, that's nothing, right? Same with narcotics. You know, 3-5 days, you know, the Jones is gone, big deal. And stimulants are even easier. You just sleep for 3 days. You know, I mean, even Bambi can do that. So acute withdrawal, okay, it's a lot of drama. You know, I'm throwing up, I'm seeing things. Oh, yeah, big deal. You know, there's nothing to that. I mean, God, hundreds of millions of us have done it. You know, it's easy. Acute withdrawal. Subacute withdrawal. Now it starts to get tough. Drinks and drugs are gone. You've got some consequences probably, but now, as your brain withdraws, you start to get nightmares. You can't sleep. You're starting to have emotional things going on. You know, you're watching the Three Stooges on TV and you're crying. You know, things aren't going so well in here. Things aren't going so well in here, and it's starting to hurt. It's starting to hurt. And you know, you can make it all go away. You just pick up, and it'll go away. So that's tough. Then, about 6 to 11, 12 weeks, we get into protracted withdrawal, and this is where most of us fall off. We can't handle it. Because now there's just this sense of things not going well, just not feeling well, feeling confused, not being able to think clearly, more nightmares, more sleep disturbance, less and less interest in certain things, foggy thinking, and most of us by that time go, well, I've had enough of this shit, man. Give me a drink. Because you know as soon as you drink, you're better. Going to the program, doing the steps, getting involved in spirituality, getting involved in helping others, doing a lot of meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days, meeting every day for a year, really helps. Exercise really helps. Good nutrition really helps. And if you make it the year with that kind of support, we know your chances are so much better because you're not withdrawing. So that's why the first year, yeah, it's a big deal.
Thank you very much.
Along the lines of nutrition, sugar, excess sugar, binge on sugar.
Right.
I know for myself, I'm an alcoholic. I binge on sugar and tend to crave alcohol. What's the chemical difference between alcohol and sugar? Is it something that we should be concerned about? I would say that anything with sugar. I myself am concerned about my blood sugar.
Well, you can alter your mood by binging on food, especially on carbohydrates, whether you pick, and then if you pick carbohydrates, if you pick those that are laden with glucose and fructose, like sugar or corn syrup, then you can actually get loaded on it. And that's what a lot of us do. You know, they stop drinking, stop smoking, and gain 100 pounds. What's going on here? So good nutrition is absolutely fundamental to recovery. And that means, you know, good nutrition combined with exercise, proper amounts of good protein, proper amounts of good fat, complex carbohydrates like grains and lots of fruits and vegetables for your carbohydrates. And, you know, Sara Lee cake and dessert and stuff. Yeah. Bye bye.
I see it as switching from one drug to another.
Right. Yeah, that's changing seats on the Titanic. You're still going down. Yeah. Yeah, you're still going down. Yeah. Right.
Okay, you guys, we're out of time. Let's give him a big hand.
All right.
Come on.
Okay. Thanks.